Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the On Air podcast. We took an unexpected break last week due to technical difficulties.
Yes, that's my fault. I hold my hands up. I'm sorry.
Yes, but we are back with part two of our abdication special sort of thing. And we are going to look at, I don't say what abdication is, we've kind of already done it, but kind of like how abdication actually works. But yeah, we thought we would start with looking at how like abdications has worked throughout sort of in the past and moving into the present day, the modern era.
Yes, I think the first thing to acknowledge is that, unfortunately, there are not a lot of primary sources from like the 12th century. So most of the information that we've got is about monarchs from the British Isles. When I was thinking about this, I think that there is maybe an attitude, I think from like TV and films and things like that, that, you know, in the olden days, it was all quite archaic and the king had full control over everything. And so he could just stand up and say, I abdicate. And that was the end. And I mean, maybe that is how it worked very long time ago. But I think there's also a bit of a misunderstanding, especially when I think about sort of the UK and how countries in the UK have worked, because I don't think we've mentioned this in the podcast yet, but the Magna Carta.
Classic Magna Carta.
Magna Carta was a very fundamental law that was introduced in England in 1215. And the Magna Carta sets out a lot of things, but amongst its provisions, it says that the king must obey the law. The king must only introduce law or policy if he has the consent of the community, so the people of the country, and that the people do not have to obey the king unconditionally. So you can see that going as far back as 1215, the idea that this monarch had like full control over everything and nobody ever advised him and the citizens were expected to just lay themselves on the ground and kiss his feet is not necessarily accurate. So by the time abdication started happening, the monarch would have advisors, a council, even something 700 years ago, 800 years ago, they still had to have a process. Like they still had laws, they still had advisors, they still, you know, it was much more sophisticated, I guess, than we might think.
Yeah, I think I definitely always thought, even modern day abdications was kind of someone going, look, I'm done with this, I'm out. And everyone went, okay then. I just kind of nodded. But there's so many like legal loopholes to jump through and so many people have to agree to it. Like if I want to quit my job, I can just do it. If you're a monarch, they're like, actually, we just debate this for 6 months first, please.
So the first one I've got is John Balliol, our Scottish fella. He was the Scottish monarch who abdicated in the 1200s, I believe. So when John, we covered this in last time's episode, but when John Balliol abdicated, he did so because he lost a war against Edward I, who was the King of England. And so it was kind of an abdication under duress. Edward forced him to abdicate. And this was one monarch forcing another monarch to abdicate. So it's slightly different from some of the later examples. But still, in order to kind of replace John and remove a monarch, Edward had John force a deed, assign a deed, sort of a legal document, which essentially forced John to agree that he had sided with Edward I's enemies. So a long time earlier, John Balliol had sworn fealty. He had sworn allegiance, I suppose, to Edward I and had said, yep, I'm on your side. I won't side with your enemies. Absolutely fine. And so then when he kind of did side with his enemies, Edward I said, well, that's grounds for me to be able to remove you because you've gone against this oath that you made to me. And so I'm going to get you to sign this legal document to show that you have indeed broken the oath. So even, you know, in the 1200s, it wasn't just Edward saying, hey, John, abdicate. And John going, okay, I abdicate. There had to be there was a formal document and Edward had to provide a justification in order to be able to remove him as a monarch. So, you know, 800 years ago, and they still had to have a legal process and a reason for doing it.
I like the part when I was Googling, so they were like, oh yeah, they tore the arms of Scotland from his surcoat. And I just like that just adds a bit of drama to things. We need to add more of that into modern day applications. More like ripping crowns from people's heads kind of thing.
Well, that is absolutely my takeaway from this first section of this podcast, is that we need a bit more drama in our abdications. And actually, I think, so the next example is Edward II, which I think is amazing.
Yes, it's slightly more dramatic. So Edward was, you know, doing his kingly things, and he was being less than popular. So he was locked up in Berkeley Castle, which is not really used as a castle today. It's a visitor centre. You can go visit it. It also has a butterfly house.
Oh, I don't. Oh, I butterfly. I like an isolated butterfly, but a whole group of butterflies freaks me out. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, I went on a school trip there in year two. And yeah, there were a lot of people like, I am not going in there. Anyway, so Edward II gets locked up in Berkeley Castle. And the sort of government bishopy people travelled all the way to Berkeley Castle to see the king. And they were like, okay, you've got two choices, pal. You can either resign and let your son be king, or we can depose you and put some random guy in charge. And then he fainted in shock and horror, which I quite liked. And then they wrote him some kind of memorandum deed thing to sign to be like, yep, I'll let my son be king. R.I.P. me. And then he got murdered. But I mean, that was after. So that was a bit more fun.
I think this is a really, really interesting example, actually, because, you know, the first example of John Balliol, that was one monarch removing another monarch. So that was slightly different. Whereas in this case, this was... the barons, the bishops, and the public, in a way, removing the monarch, which even in the 1300s, they knew that that was a massive thing to do. And so they had a whole, they had a whole parliament where they talked about it and debated, like, can we do this? Is this legal? How do we do this? Because we've never done this before in England. We don't know how this works. And they created something called the Articles of Accusation. And essentially, in the Articles of Accusation, they summarized all the reasons that they didn't like him. What the document did was essentially argue that all of these things that he had done violated his coronation oath that he had taken, and so therefore their argument was that he'd kind of abdicated himself because he'd violated the oath. And so I think it kind of goes back to that Magna Carta thing of, like, for a long time the monarch had been in this contract with the public of, like, I have to do things in a certain way, and I promise that to you, and you can support me, but it's not unconditional. And so in their view, he had violated his oath, and so they had grounds to remove him. And it was, I think it was 22 people in the end who went to go and visit him.
Yeah, it was so many and such a mixture. So it wasn't like one person being like, okay, I'm the one that's more important than the king. It was just like, we as a group of people, bishops, barons, builders, we all think you're rubbish.
Yeah. But I really like the process of how they did it, in terms of, like, the ceremony of it.
It was, they kind of did like a reverse coronation, which they've done they do a few times, comes up again. But he signed his sort of memorandum. And at this point, his son, Edward III, was kind of already acting as king in London, because it took them quite a while to get cross country back in the day.
Back in the day.
So they kind of kept him in Berkeley Castle for the rest of his life. And they kind of just took everything away from him, because it makes me sound really emotional, and I'm not emotional about this. But it feels like they kind of just, like, slowly, in a big sort of, he signed things, and as he signed his rights away, and he was signing them specifically, sort of, I am as the king, I'm no longer the king, and I declare he's the king, but now I'm not the king. Mm. It's very specifically dramatic.
Yeah, so kind of the reverse coronation thing, you had a guy named William Trussell, who formally renounced homage or homage. We never actually settled how you pronounce that. But basically, as you might remember from the coronation, that there's a moment where different people go and swear essentially loyalty to the monarch on behalf of whoever they represent. So the royal family, William did it on behalf of the royal family, other people do it on behalf of the citizens of the nation. And so he went and on behalf of the kingdom, he officially renounced homage. And then a dude called Thomas Blunt broke the staff Which is something that we might remember from the Queen's funeral, where it was like the end of the reign. They broke his special stick that he has, and that was like signifying that this reign had ended. So it was kind of like a mix of a coronation in reverse and a funeral, of kind of like, it was all the things that we gave you officially, we are now ceremonially taking them away from you. Which I thought was quite interesting. And then as you say, he died not long afterwards, because I think it was very uncomfortable. There's disputes about how he died, but I think it was very uncomfortable for them to have a living monarch. They worried about whether it would undermine the institution of the monarchy to have somebody who'd been abdicated. They'd come up with some legal justification for why they did it, but they still were uncomfortable with the fact that they had done it. So I think, they took it very seriously, even in the 1300s.
Yeah, I think because obviously this happened in January 1327, and it was by the end of January, so they made this decision. They've got the public whipped up and had all their sort of debating on the 13th. They got to see Edward on the 20th. They took away their homage on the 21st, and then they were like, "Yep, he's willingly abdicated. Thanks, guys." And then crowned his son on the first, which is a very quick turnaround. I think probably because he was still alive and just sort of loitering, but they very much kept him locked up in Berkeley Castle, and he died suspiciously soon afterwards, within a couple of years. Well, within one year, really. It was later that same year he died. So it was a kind of a we have a king, and we have this old king who could. I think particularly at the time, who could like have an get an army behind him and come back for his throne if we just don't get rid of him.
And not even just that, but also the fact that even if he'd been like, you know what, I'm fine, I don't want to battle, I'll just sit and knit, or I'll learn to dance, or whatever they did in prison in those days. I think there was a concern that people would think, well, what's the point in us having a monarch or having any kind of governance, and sort of following the state and not just having rebellions constantly? Because we used to believe that this monarch was appointed by God, and now the people can remove him. And so, if that can happen for just because he's not very popular, why should we support this entire thing? What we thought was true is not true. And so there was like an existential question that it brought up.
I remember going to Berkeley Castle back on my year two school trip,
Oh, fun.
and they have like a dungeon. Obviously, you can look down, they've got a skull down there. They're like, that's King Edward the Second's head.
It's real Ed.
I don't know if it's his real head. I almost assume not, because it was a king, and at some point someone would have gone, hang on, maybe we should take his head out of the dungeon he died in.
Yeah,
But yeah,
probably.
I always think they're very gory for 6-year-olds. They were like, and this is how he was murdered here. We were also there like, okay.
Why are we like this?
Why do you tell children these things?
Is a skull to represent the person who died in here. Like, so weird. But I think anyway, that ceremony, as you say, is something that I would definitely like to be brought back, because there are other examples. So the other main example is Queen Christina of Sweden. She abdicated in 1654, and what I love about her abdication is that she wore her whole regalia, so like the big, velvety cape and all of those things, and it was ceremonially, I can't say this word, ceremonially removed from her piece by piece, the regalia, until she was left in just a simple white dress to kind of show her sort of, I guess, detransition from being the monarch to being just an ordinary person. And I think they should have done that with Margrethe. They should have had her turn up in a cloak and then just strip her, I guess, in not such a, that sounds very terrible, but in a ceremonial stripping, not like stripping.
Yeah, definitely. I like my favorite part about Christine as well is that she had to sort of take the crown off herself, because she was at that point she was still the queen, so no one else could take her crown off. So she just kind of was like, "Okay, I'll do it. It's all right, guys. Don't worry, I've got this."
It's the kind of thing that in the UK they would argue about in for ages, about like the constitutional implications of who is allowed to touch the crown and who isn't, and they'd find some rule from 1444 that says that this person's not allowed to, and we'd talk about it for ages. It would be a really big thing. So
Yeah, they'd be like, only farmers called John, born in October, can do this. They'd be like, does anyone know any farmers called John? Yeah, and then he'd become a knight afterwards. So the other sort of oldie, worldie British one I had was Mary Queen of Scots. She was again a monarch sort of resigning from prison. And it's kind of like the third example because for John Balliol, it was a king removing his power. And then for Edward II, it was a king and the people, not the king, it was the people and the barons and the bishops removing a king's power. And in Mary Queen of Scots, it was like the aristocracy removing her power because it was the sort of other lords and ladies of Scotland. And she kind of had to, they just gave her a bunch of letters and all the different things, and she had to sign them. Like, this one says that my half brother's gonna be my regent, and this one says that my son will be the next king, and this one says that I resign the crown. And I just think it's kind of like these three sort of strands. And if I was ever going to think about oldie worldie abdications, that's the one that I think of, like r other rich people taking the crown away.
I think, and also she just had a miscarriage. So she was quite seriously ill, and they just presented her with a bunch of documents and kind of forced her into it. So, I mean, she had a terrible time. We'll have to talk about Mary Queen of Scots at some point because she really had a really awful experience. People like, we always get taught that she's kind of an idiot and just wasn't very good at being queen, but actually, she had a lot of people who were making it very difficult. I mean, she just had a miscarriage and she had to, and people were giving her a document, being like, can you sign this and agree to give up your throne forever? Thanks, bye, to your baby boy.
Yeah,
Like,
can your ch infant child be the
yeah.
monarch instead of you?
Just yeah. So that wasn't entirely fair of the Scots, I'll be honest. And there was no cere there was no cool ceremony involved in that one.
Yeah, no. At no point did they take the crown off her head because she was in
No.
a prison, didn't have a crown.
Yeah. No, I mean that's more like the style that kind of developed after the 19th century. Is this more sort of like just it's an official documentation. So there wasn't as much of this sort of ceremonial stuff going on. Like examples, I've got of Christian Frederick in 1814. So he wrote a draft abdication document himself, but it was then discussed with Parliament and they added in some provisions. I think one of them was his descendants couldn't be on the throne. And then eventually they came up with an agreement and he signed it. And then Amadeo I is another one that I found in 1873. He wrote a letter to the government saying that he wanted to abdicate, and then kind of Congress and Senate like formally accepted it from him. So there was always some sort of documentation and some sort of involvement from Parliament. It wasn't just the monarch going, I want to abdicate, that's the end. There was always, you know, this kind of process, but it's sort of when we get into the 19th century that we start to see it becoming more like it is in the modern era of, you know, nobody getting stripped, sadly.
Yeah, boring abdications.
Boring. But yeah, then we move into the modern era.
Yeah, if we look at modern abdications, we've kind of grouped these together depending on how they abdicated. But the first one we're looking at is the UK and the abdication of Edward the Seventh
Eighth.
in the 19th 8th. Was he the eighth?
Yeah, he was the eighth.
Edward the Eighth
People are
in
going to be
the
shocked if they're listening to this, like,
1900s.
Edward the Seventh abdicated. How did that happen?
Spoilers, putting another one in. But yeah, no, he didn't abdicate, sadly. Edward the Eighth did. Didn't even know we got up to an eighth. I thought it was only Henry. Shocked me.
I know.
Yeah, he abdicated in the 1930s. And obviously, last episode, we spoke about how, even though it was kind of his choice to abdicate, he'd been kind of forced into making that choice. So it was all kind of the government were very much on the side of wanting him to abdicate rather than some other countries where they were quite reluctant. But they had to make it legal because at that point there wasn't a law just saying the king could opt out of being king. So they had to pe pass a law called the Declaration of Abdication Act 1936. And they passed it really, really quickly, like within a day. Like they introduced it in the morning, went through all the houses, and then the king had to give royal assent to the bill, and then he signed it, which is hilarious. And then he abdicated. And sort of as that was happening, it was simultaneously happening in all the other realms. So it's like he
Yes.
then abdicated for the next 3 or 4 days continuously.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So he wrote a letter initially saying that he wanted to renounce the throne, but obviously that wasn't strong enough. It wasn't actually official until he'd given assent to the act, which, yeah, it's like signing your own execution warrant, isn't it? It's quite funny. I think the most interesting thing about the legal side of the act around Edward's abdication is that they put in a provision that also renounced the throne for all of his descendants. And that is something that is quite unique in abdications, and obviously as a result of kind of the circumstances, which was sort of like, he was partly abdicating because his wife was inappropriate. George already had two children, and so it would have caused a huge complication if his son had he'd had a son and his son had popped up and been like, actually, I should be monarch, it shouldn't be Elizabeth. That would have caused a massive headache for everyone. So they included this sort of additional provision that, if he had any children in the future, they wouldn't be added to the line of succession, which is, relatively unique within abdication in the modern era. It was much more common in the past, but in the modern era, it's quite unique.
Yeah, like nowadays, most monarchs are abdicating for their children. So they're like, not
With their
you.
adult
You don't get a
children.
chance. Yes. And I do like the fact just how fast the abdication sort of act happened, because I think it's about 40 years to pass any kind of laws in the UK because it goes through so many things. So I just like the fact someone went, everyone signs this, we get it done today, and then we actually think about it again.
It reminded me
Never
of
done.
at the end, not long after Charles took the throne, he changed the who could be a councillor of state. So that's essentially, if you don't know, like a temporary regent, somebody who stands in for the monarch when they're overseas for a couple of weeks, or when they're, right now having surgery, potentially. So the councillor of state steps in, and it had been outlined by law who could be it, and obviously Harry and Andrew were on that list and can't do it for various reasons. So they basically added Anne and Edward in. But it was basically like Charles wrote a letter to the government and was like, I'd really like it if you could add Anne and Edward in. And then they went, okay, yeah, sure. And then it was done in like 7 seconds. And we'd been spent years worrying about what would happen, and would we end up having to have Beatrice as a councillor of state, and how would that work? And we'd spent years talking about it, and then it was done in 5 seconds.
Yeah, with no build up at all. It was like a
No.
surprise. We've done this now.
No. The next example that I have on my list is Belgium. So the two most recent abdications in Belgium have been Leopold III and Albert II. And they also had to have a new abdication act that was created in because the constitution in Belgium doesn't mention abdication at all. So they had to create this new act to allow it to happen. It was essentially just the same process as the UK, really, of like, you sign the Abdication Act and then it becomes official. It was basically like signing any law, except that it was done in front of all of the cameras, which it wouldn't normally be, because it's not normally such a groundbreaking sort of law. So yeah, I mean, it's very, very similar in some ways to the UK, because it's just we create the government created an act, the monarch signed it, the end.
Yeah, I think the only sort of bonus thing is that for Leopold the Third, they had to do a referendum first,
Yes, of
which
course.
is always funny to me, mainly because we did like two referendums in Britain within the span of about a year, and they both went disastrously wrong, and it's caused huge kerfuffles ever since. But I like the fact that Leopold was like, "Look, I messed up. I need to get out of here. I want to live in Belgium, but let me get out of here." And they were like, "No, we're gonna let the people vote on this." Like, it's the X Factor. It's like, can he live here and be king? Can he live here and not be king? Does he have to leave? What do you all want? And yeah, I just like that. I think we should do more for referendums on dramatic things where people live. So the other one, kind of in this category, is Japan, who, despite having done many abdications for many hundreds of years, by the time it got to 2019, it was no longer okay to abdicate. So they had to once again put in a special law, the law for special exemption of the House law concerning abdication of emperor, which is a very long name.
Rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
It's just so snappy.
Mm.
So Emperor Akihito had said he wanted to abdicate because he was old and not very well in 2016, and they had to, and then they had 14 meetings of the government and the imperial household and the emperor over the year when they decided they would have to make a new law so it could finally happen. And then they agreed the law on the 19th of May 2017. It came into effect on the 16th of June, and then the government were like, okay, so this is the plan of the timeline for the next 2 years until you actually abdicate. Which is a much longer version of events than it did in Britain or Belgium. Took like 4 years, but it did happen.
Japan's slightly unique again in that so they're what they were what they were altering with the law that they introduced was the Imperial Household Law of 1947, and that law specifically states that the monarch reigns until death. Most constitutions sort of say, well, they don't really say anything about, you know, they just say the monarch is reigning and then somebody else comes along and replaces them. But the Japanese law said specifically the monarch reigns until death, which obviously prevents abdication. And one thing that's, yeah, as Grace mentioned, is slightly unusual is that it took a bit longer. So when they passed the law, they said that this is the process that Akihito would have to do to abdicate. And the law was valid for 3 years. So he could have, you know, theoretically could have done the process and abdicated at any point in the next 3 years. But it means that if Naruhito, the current emperor of Japan, wants to abdicate, the law that was passed is no longer valid. So they would have to do this again.
Yeah, they were not really leaving us open to other
No,
abdications. They were like, that's
definitely
not how
not.
we do things. We're kind of running into a constitutional crisis in Japan. We're going to slow this down.
Yes, we can't be losing any more royals. Yeah, so then there's one that kind of isn't a, I put it in an in-betweeny category because I've grouped all of these together because they all passed a new law. And so then there's Spain, which did pass a new law, but the reasons that they passed a new law were slightly different. So the first countries that we mentioned all passed a law because there was nothing in there was nothing that existed already that said that they could abdicate. There was no law that said that already, or there was a law that said that they specifically couldn't abdicate, so they had to change it in that. So they had to pass a law. Whereas in Spain, the process for abdication is actually laid out in the constitution, and it says what you have to do. So they did pass a new law, what was called an organic law, which is basically like a fundamental law that governs the state. So a constitution is an example of an organic law. And so they had to pass a new organic law. But they weren't doing it, you know, in the previous examples, they were all sort of like, we don't really know how to do this. Let's just pass a new law. Whereas in this case of Spain, the reason they were passing a new law is because the constitution very handily tells them exactly what to do.
It's like you need to pass a law and then it can happen. They're like, great, thank you.
Yeah.
I like the fact it gave us the vote breakdown as well because it was not unanimously for, even though everyone was like, yeah, good idea, Juan Carlos, time to abdicate. Like 19 people were like, no, I disagree. I think you should just stay as king. The next country is Denmark. Why not go to Denmark? Because this country is one where they did not have to pass a new law. Kind of the next twist. And in Denmark, they had to sign some papers in a Council of State meeting. And that's kind of it. Not really much else that happened.
So the Act of Succession in 1953, which governs who becomes the monarch and all those sorts of things, says that a monarch can abdicate. So she just had to sign a piece of paper and that was it.
I mean, it's short and sweet.
As it was, if you listen to our review.
And the other country in that category is the Netherlands, because they also have to sign a piece of paper. And that's kind of it. These are the nice short ones. Nice. These are the most bore of all the abdications, because no laws have to be passed and no one gets stripped of regalia. They just sign some paper in a wearing a suit in a room with politicians. That's so boring.
I think to an observer, it might not feel like a different process because if you look at King Albert II's abdication versus Queen Beatrix in the Netherlands, her abdication, or Margrethe's, they look exactly the same. It's somebody in a room in a casual outfit signing a piece of paper. But the process behind it is very different. Like there's a m much more parliamentary involvement because they have to pass a new act in the case of King Albert. Or they, you know, what the document they're signing is a legal act as opposed to what's called an instrument of abdication, which is just basically a sort of declaration that I'm abdicating, but it's signed and official. So it's kind of like it feels like the same process if you're not following all of the legal stuff that's going on in the background. But if you do follow that legal stuff in the background, it's actually quite a different thing that's going on.
It's a bit like Okay, I'm going for a baking analogy here. It's a bit like you're eating a Victoria sponge, and in Denmark and Holland, you're just eating when you bought from the shop. But in the other countries, you've baked the cake yourself, and now you're eating it. It's a bit more exciting.
Yes, that's a really good analogy. Like if somebody comes into your house to visit, they just see the cake, but they don't know all the process that went into it in the background. So that's an excellent analogy, Grace. That was well. Did you think of that on the spot?
I did.
That was
I was just
great.
thinking, what? How can I add to this? I was like, oh, cake.
Great. I always like an analogy with cake. I think it really brings everything to life. Yeah, and then so the last one we have in terms of the legal process is Luxembourg, who kind of have their own little category, which I really enjoy. In Luxembourg, the succession to the throne and all of that kind of stuff about who can be monarch and how the process works, that is all done by something called a house decree, which is essentially just like the monarchy of the royal family of Luxembourg decide what the law is for the royal family of Luxembourg. Kind of like how the queen in the UK can decide who gets to be prince and princess within her family and doesn't have to consult the government on that. That's her decision. In Luxembourg, the succession to the throne is governed by this house decree. They do kind of have to sign a document and things, but it's basically just their own document. Like they don't have to go through parliament, they don't have to get anything separate passed. It's really just kind of their own process that they do.
Yeah, and I think even though I think Grand Duchess Charlotte and Grand Duchess Marie Adelaide and Grand Duke Jean kind of abdicated in different circumstances, they all had exactly the same method. Like they all politely let the government know they were going to do it. And even, I think Marie Adelaide was a bit more suggested to her she would abdicate, but there's even with those differences, like they weren't like sitting down Marie Adelaide in a room and being like, now sign the document. It was all in-house.
I think I was trying to work out like why is it that they all have these different processes? And I think that it seems to be whatever governs the line of succession is what is used as the basis for how they abdicate. So in Luxembourg, there's a house law. So all they all have to do is just basically do a press statement that says, I'm abdicating, because it's their decision anyway how the succession goes. In the UK, our succession is governed by a separate Act of Parliament. And so in order to change that in a way, we have to have a new Act of Parliament. And then in countries like Spain or even Denmark and the Netherlands, it says in the constitution either this is how you abdicate, like in Spain, or in the Netherlands and Denmark, it says, doesn't say how you abdicate, but it says you can abdicate. Like it's a theoretical thing that is allowed in the constitution. And so therefore, they don't need to sign, they don't need a new law because there's already a law that says that they can abdicate. They just need a document to sort of make it official. So that's what I kind of came up with is like the reasoning behind why there's a different process. It's sort of like if it's in law, they have to pass a law. If it's already covered in the law, they don't need to pass anything new because it's already covered. It is a little bit complicated because then I started thinking about like Sweden. And so in Sweden, they haven't had a modern abdication, so we don't really know what the process would be and how it would go. It does say in the Swedish constitution that abdication is possible. And so theoretically, you think it would go like in the Netherlands or in Denmark, where the monarch just has to sign a piece of paper. But in Sweden, the monarch doesn't have any executive power. They don't sign the laws. Unlike in Denmark and the Netherlands. And so, would a declaration from the king saying, I abdicate, be enough? Or would the government feel like they have to pass a new law? So, I've come up with a process of why I think things work the way that they do so far, but there are these outliers where, like, Sweden could pop up and decide to abdicate, and they might have to do things completely differently, and we don't know. So, just be wary if something happens in the future and there's an abdication that doesn't work in the way that I've said it would. I have said that that's possible.
Yeah, I think, we've only got like three modern European monarchies where there haven't been abdications, Monaco, Norway, and Sweden. And Monaco's only ever had one ever. So
Yeah.
they're just not abdicating very much there because it's a really old royal family as well. But I think it's really interesting to think about what they would be like. I mean, I don't know the likelihood of anyone abdicating in any of those countries, but it would be interesting because I would always assume that Norway and Sweden would follow the sort of Danish sort of method and Monaco would follow the Luxembourg method. But knowing the way royals work, they would do something completely different.
Yeah, I think they always do that, don't they? Of like, you think you've got the system worked out, and then they just change it. Like, I'm still really angry about the fact that monarchs went to Charles's coronation, because we were told for ages that crowned monarchs do not go to the coronation of other crowned monarchs, and that's not a thing that happens, and it hasn't happened historically. And then Charles was like, no, I'm going to invite them, and then they all went, yeah, we'll go, and ruined that entire thing. It's like, well, why do you tell us that these are the rules and then just not do the rules? So, of course, the actual practicalities of an abdication, which is what we're talking about today, is not just about the legal stuff. It's also about all of the other things that the monarch does on a practical level, and all of these other sort of practical considerations. And one of those that we've identified is what happens to the titles. And so I think, historically, there doesn't seem to be much consistency, but there are examples. So, like Edward II, again, he lost his title entirely and was known as Edward of Caernarfon, which was in Wales where he was born. Sometimes he was also called the king's father. Sometimes they would have had another place where they were monarch, and so they could just use that title instead. So it didn't, they weren't monarch of this country, but they were monarch of a different country. Sometimes they were still just called by their old title. And that's something that happens in titles anyway, of like, if you look at old documents, you might see somebody who we call princess such and such being referred to as lady such and such. And that's, they weren't as wedded to the title system as we are in the modern era. So yeah, historically, not much consistency, but nowadays there does t tend to be a little bit more consistency in terms of how things are organized. Nobody goes by exactly the same thing as they were before when they were monarch. We might call them the same thing, like I'm still calling Margrethe Queen Margrethe, which is what I called her before, but they're a sort of official title. Nobody there there's always something that changes in order to kind of signify the fact that their position has changed, but what the actual change is depends.
So the first category we've got is the category of change, and they both changed, but this is more of a big change. So these are monarchs where their title is not the same title kind of in any way, shape, or form. So an example would be King Edward VIII of the United Kingdom, who after he abdicated became the Duke of Windsor. So he went from being His Majesty the King to His Royal Highness the Duke of Windsor. Or, even to a lesser extent in the Netherlands, they go from being Their Majesty the Monarch, so Her Majesty Queen Beatrix, the Queen, to Her Royal Highness Princess Beatrix. So it's often a swap to a lower version of a title, so still a royal title, but it's a lower down version than the monarch's.
Yes, definitely. And I think when Edward VIII abdicated, because abdication is not a traditional thing in the UK in the way that it is in the Netherlands, there was a lot of discussion about like league, as I mentioned earlier, like we do end up just having these weird little constitutional discussions where there's like five men in a room who are talking about this, who all know loads about the constitution and have really strong opinions. And like the Attorney General got involved. And so there was all this kind of discussion about the legality of it. So then after he abdicated, his brother, the new king, George VI, gave him the title to kind of clear up the mess, gave him the title of His Royal Highness, the Duke of Windsor. His wife was not supposed to use the title and the HRH and such, but she did. But anyway, that's a different matter. Yeah, that's the title that was given to him. And Windsor was obviously chosen because it was the sort of house name of the family. But there's a couple of interesting things about that. So the first is one of the reasons that they gave him a specific title was because at the time, under the rules, if you were a peer, so if you had a dukedom or another title like that, you couldn't stand for election as a member of parliament. And so they specifically gave him that title because they knew that it would prevent him from running as an MP, which they were worried about. And also by making him an HRH, it meant that he couldn't speak in the House of Lords. So basically, the reason they gave him a title wasn't just to be like, well, we'll recognize the 6 seconds that you were monarch. It was because it prevented him from running for office.
So it's like particularly in the Arab countries when they've had abdications, they tend to then be like, okay, I'm abdicating so I can be prime minister, and they're like, okay, now I'm going to be king again. I'm going to be prime minister again. So they're just like, no, we're not doing that. We're cutting that one off straight away.
Yeah, I think they were really worried about him running as an MP, and so they were like, "No, nah, we'll give you a new title, and that prevents that from happening." And also, So historically, titles were created, and it was sort of specified that they would be descended, they'd be inherited by your male line descendants. In the case of Edward VIII, when he was given his new title, it was said specifically that his wife and his descendants couldn't hold the title. So if Edward and Wallace had had a child, that child would not be entitled to be the Duke of Windsor. We wouldn't have loads of Dukes of Windsor running around, which is quite unusual. You know, I think obviously they did it recently with Edward and the Duke of Edinburgh title, but up until then, it was something that was incredibly unusual to have a title that was only given to one person.
They were like, yeah, we're not losing the Windsor title. That's a bit too special to us.
Yeah, and then yeah, in the Netherlands, I think it's slightly different because it is traditional now. So we know kind of when the monarch abdicates, they're probably going to go back to what they were called before.
Yeah, I always hope Queen Beatrix is my tag on Tumblr, and I'm like, do I have her saved as that tag, or did I go like sensible and save her as Princess Beatrix? I don't know. It feels wrong to write princess.
No, I know. She's too dignified. Too dignified to be just a princess. So, the other category we have is kind of there is a change, but I've said it's more like a twist. Something that I've talked about quite a lot in titles or around on Tumblr around titles is this use of the word the. And the is the definite article, so it means it's the only one. So if somebody said, "Can you pass me a sponge?" then they could be talking about any sponge. If they said, "Can you pass me the sponge?" they're talking about a specific sponge usually. And so when you have a monarch, usually their title is His Majesty or Her Majesty, the King or Queen of the country. After abdication, a lot of the time, the new monarch goes from, the new monarch becomes His Majesty, the King of country. And so the old monarch generally becomes His Majesty, King, their name. Usually, this is something that is done as a courtesy. It's not often a matter of law, like they could be called anything. But as a courtesy of the position that they once held, they still go by King or Queen and Majesty. For example, in Belgium, Albert went from His Majesty the King of the Belgians to His Majesty King Albert II. Margrethe officially went from the Queen of Denmark to Queen Margrethe, although, people have always called her Queen Margrethe. In Spain, similarly, he went from King of Spain to King Juan Carlos. Also, something interesting is that they sometimes differentiate by dropping the numerals. So, for example, if they do call Felipe the King of, King Felipe in documents or whatever, they'll call him King Felipe the Sixth. So they don't always call him the King of Spain. They might call him King Felipe the Sixth. But with King Juan Carlos, they just call him Juan Carlos. They don't include the numbers. So that's another way that they sometimes differentiate it is like if they do want to use the more informal title and use the person's name, they will drop the numeral if it's no longer the reigning monarch.
Back in the olden days, when people were more formal about things, it probably would be a lot more notable because they would always have been Her Majesty the Queen. And but now with social media, people are just like, oh yeah, Queen Margrethe, or Queen Elizabeth, or so it just sounds like the same name. But it's the magic there. It's the magic there. It's so important.
Yes, technically, officially. Oh, it's also the same in Luxembourg.
Yes, from the Grand Duchess to Grand Duchess.
The one interesting example in this category is in Japan, because they use a title, I don't know how you pronounce it, but it's like Joko or something like that, which that title was historically the one that was given to abdicated monarchs. And it doesn't translate nicely into English. So the English translation that is generally used is Emperor Emeritus. And so Juan Carlos is sometimes called King Emeritus as well, in the press and things. But that was something that was laid out in the imperial abdication law that was passed. So it kind of outlined what his new title would be. So in a lot of these situations, it's not, there's, you know, well, you know, in Denmark, there wasn't a law that was passed for Margrethe to become to abdicate, and so there wasn't any law that they could have said what her new title would be. It's all just like by courtesy that the government and everyone else in Denmark is like, okay, well, we all agree we'll call her this. Whereas in Japan, because you know they were introducing this new law to kind of amend the ban on abdication, essentially, they also used that opportunity to kind of say what the new title would be.
I think I always like the Japan method, not the whole method, but I like the fact they've got like a special title because we have it for living spouses of deceased monarchs, like the Queen Mother, or I like the concept of them having like their own special title to show that they were a monarch, but they're now not the monarch anymore. Especially now, there's such a sort of lack, not like I'm saying there should be more formality. I like to use names when I talk about people. So I like to say like King Charles III rather than the King of the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth Realms, which is a mouthful.
Fair enough. Our podcast would be like 3 times longer if you said that every single time.
Yeah, but like if he ever abdicated, I'd still be calling him like King Charles and King William rather than, and I think if he had a different title, like, you know, the old king, it would sound a bit different.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a good title. The only thing that's coming to mind is DJ. DJ Migrator. Yeah. Yeah, so that's titles, really. I think, you know, as with a lot of things that we see throughout this episode, a lot of it depends on the circumstance of what happened. So if somebody like Edward VIII, he reigned for 10 seconds and nobody liked him, so they weren't going to let him keep being king. There was no way that was going to happen. Whereas in most other situations, it's kind of like, you know, we want to honor the fact that you were the monarch for such a long period of time, and so we'll let you kind of keep the thing. The Netherlands is really the outlier, and I don't know if there is a particular reason why they go by that, they sort of downgrade themselves.
So the next thing to look at as to what happens after someone abdicates is kind of, where do they go? Whether that is specifically like which house are they living in, or like physically where they are. And the first category is, I've called it exile, which is possibly slightly too strong a title for some of them. It's sort of exile, it's probably the better title, but it is when the monarch has to leave the country. And I think historically that was definitely the go-to option, you know, even going back to the early 1900s, it, you know, like Maria Adelaide or Leopold III, they were exiled politically. But sort of more recent examples, I think some of these are exactly the same time. But Edward VIII is always going to be a great example for everything. He was essentially exiled to France with Wallace, because they were like, yeah, you can't be here. We don't want you, well, specifically Wallace in the UK anymore. Or Juan Carlos, who at the time didn't necessarily get exiled because he still lived in Spain, but has since fled to the country in disgrace. So the monarchs who can't really remain where they were because of public sentiment towards them.
Juan Carlos, he initially stayed in Spain, and he initially stayed in Zarzuela, which is the palace that he'd lived in since the 60s. But then he kind of went into exile in Abu Dhabi. It was sort of self-imposed exile, but also because they were kind of investigating his financial activities. And so until that was sorted out, he didn't really come back to Spain at all. He has started to come back more now. But I don't think that he stays in royal properties when he does come back. And he doesn't have like, I don't think he has like an official home as such.
He was like, I'm not going to prison. Yeah. I'm off.
And then in the UK, he gave a radio broadcast, Edward VIII, to the public about his abdication, and then left for Austria pretty much immediately. Oh, it was the next day he left for Austria.
Yeah, he was like, I'm off, bye.
Yeah, he was like, bye, see ya. I know, when we were joking about Queen Margrethe kind of leaving the abdication very quickly and going back to her house, at least she didn't go to Austria.
She stayed in the country.
Stayed in Denmark, yeah. although, interestingly, he did still own Balmoral and Sandringham, so he did still own properties that are now part of the royal family's collection, and he had inherited them because he was the eldest son and they were private property, and so his brother had to purchase them from him in order for them to be back in the royal collection. Otherwise, if, you know, if he hadn't done that, then Balmoral and Sandringham wouldn't be properties that the royals live in. The Queen couldn't have died at Balmoral.
Yeah, what would she have done?
Yeah, no.
It's very much like a very Edward VIII thing to be like, I could probably still be king one day. I'll just keep them for now.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. He lived in France with Wallace, but he always expected to return home. When you look at like his letters and things, he always thought that one day he'd be able to come home and everything would be fine. But he was basically told, I mean, this will come up later on in more detail, but he was basically told, you'll be cut off if you come to the UK without an invitation. And so he was exiled in all but name. It wasn't like there was a law saying, you know, you can't come into the country ever, but he was pretty much told, sorry, mate. And so, yeah.
I do like the fact that the UK had like the last serious exiling in Europe. Feels right somehow.
Yeah. Overly dramatic. Yeah. Yeah, so the next category that we've got is royals who kind of moved house. They stayed in
Also
a country. Not so
dramatic.
dramatic. They stayed in a country. No one was exiled, but they moved house. A few examples of this: the Netherlands. So Beatrix had lived in Houstonbosch. I don't know if that's how you say it. That's what I'm going to go with until her abdication, and then she moved to Drakenstein Castle, which is her private property, and she actually lived there up until she became queen. So she reverted her title back to princess, and she reverted her house back to the one she lived in when she was. So I quite like that. She basically just reset the clock. There's also Luxembourg. That this is actually a bit of a mixed one, but Grand Duke Jean moved from Berg Castle to Fischbach. But actually, Grand Duchess Charlotte, who had abdicated before him, she lived in Fischbach, however you pronounce it, throughout her reign and then after her abdication. And then the last example that I have is Japan. So the emperor and empress moved out of the imperial palace and into Takanawa residence, and then later into a renovated home in the Akasaka estate, which apparently Naruhito, the current emperor, had previously lived in Akasaka. So yeah, those are the ones who moved to and are still a royal property, or in some cases a property they owned separately. Still very nice. No one was exiled. No one was made to live in a box under a bridge. So, they all still had it very cushy. They just might have had to move out of the house they'd lived in for a while.
Yeah, I like the fact that, like, oh no, I'm not monarch anymore. I have to just live in one of my other
Yeah.
castles.
Oh no. What a
Happen to
downgrade.
have.
Yeah.
Clearly, why they have so many, just in case they have loads of abdicated monarchs, they can just scatter them around the country.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And then the final mini category are the monarchs who didn't move at all. There's some of them, like King Albert the Second of Belgium, just stayed where he was. Or in Denmark, when Margrethe stayed in the same palace, but they kind of moved the flag. So her house wasn't the big special monarch's house anymore. And then Frederick's house became the big special monarch's house. A bit like they've definitely not done in the UK, but also definitely have done secretly. With Charles not moving into Buckingham Palace. But they just, yeah, some of them just don't move. They're like, nope, I like this house and I was monarch, so can't do much about it.
Yeah. So Albert lives in a place called Belvedere. He could have moved into the Palace of Laeken, which is where King Philippe and his family currently live. But he chose not to when he became monarch, so he just stayed in the same place and they moved into the big house. And then the Amalienborg Palace complex, I think we mentioned this in the last episode, but it's basically four identical mansions built around a courtyard. So it doesn't really matter which of the identical mansions you live in. They're all identical. So the flag is the important thing there. To kind of summarize what happens with properties, I think that as we mentioned, lots of monarchs kind of historically have been exiled because of the circumstances of their abdication. Because before, it was only really in the 20th century that we started to get abdications as a tradition. In the modern era, that is a lot less likely to happen. We don't tend to exile people very often these days. But kind of beyond that, nowadays it's a lot easier because most royal families have like a main house. So we've got Buckingham Palace, for example, Sweden. They've got the Royal Palace in Stockholm. There's the palace in Dam Square in the Netherlands. But most of the time, the monarch doesn't live all the time in the main house. So in Sweden, the King of Sweden does not live in the Royal Palace in Stockholm. In the Netherlands, the Dutch royals do not live in the palace in Dam Square. They only go there for work and like ceremonies and stuff like that. So nobody has to move out of the main house that is like the monarch's house because nobody lives there anyway. So because they're all in these kind of lower houses, it's often just a case of like personal preference or if one's slightly nicer than the other, they might switch. But generally, if somebody's lived in the same house since the 1960s and there's plenty of houses to go around, they just kind of stay where they are. It's a bit like house musical chairs.
It's just like house musical chairs. Yeah, and I think we're so used now to like the monarchs having like a summer home or a summer yacht, and a winter home and a normal home and a working home. Like, it's not a big deal. Like, it doesn't matter Margrethe stayed exactly where she is because, her actual house you know, her bedroom is not where the seat of royal power is, so it doesn't matter quite as much.
And I think because we have so many other royals who do work, not just the monarch, they all live in like commuting distance anyway. Nowadays, it's just like, what's available? What's nice? Where do you feel comfortable?
Yeah, nowadays it's also nice and talking about like
Yeah.
feelings and stuff like that.
And more exile, more drama. So the next section we're going to look at is what everyone loves to talk about. It's the money. Money, 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 money. I sing that every single time I mention the word money, and I usually cut it out. So we'll see if it makes it this time. There's a couple of categories again. And the first category I've got is those who lose their money, essentially. So, as you know, a monarch is funded by the state in all of the countries that we're talking about today. And so, what do you do after a monarch abdicates? Do you continue to fund them? So, the first is the UK. Edward VIII was not put on the civil list. So, at the time, the civil list is the name of the payments that were going to members of the royal family for their official duties. So, Edward VIII was not on the civil list, which meant that he wasn't getting any state funding. He wasn't entirely cut off, though, I will say, because I mentioned earlier that, you know, he owned Balmoral and Sandringham, so he had to sell them to his brother for like millions of pounds. And he was also given an allowance by his brother, the king, every year from his sort of personal money. So it wasn't state money. He was cut off from the state, but he was getting money from his brother. And that was how the arrangement worked that I mentioned, of like him saying, I will cut you off and not give you your allowance if you come to the UK without my permission. And so, he went, okay, well, I want my money, so I'll stay in France. It reminded me a lot of the arrangement with Prince Andrew, which is like, Prince Andrew does not receive state funding, but I would be very surprised if he doesn't get an allowance from Charles.
Yeah, I always like the term allowance because it's also what we refer to, like when we're talking about children's pocket money, except in this case, it's like millions of pounds.
Yeah.
Like, your allowance this year is like £1 million, so don't come back or we take it away from you.
Yeah, I don't really know if it works the same way as pocket money, where like you go up to your mum once a week and you're like, can I get my pocket money, please? And she hands over a check for £1 million.
Tidy my bedroom.
Yeah, I did my chore wheel. Look, you know. But the other example that I have, unsurprisingly, because we seem to be hand in hand, is Spain. So initially, Juan Carlos did have an annual stipend from the state of about €200,000. But then when the corruption accusations started to turn on him, Felipe stripped him of his annual stipend in 2020.
I remember him doing that. That was such a good moment for Felipe.
It was such a decisive moment, like very awkward, I imagine, to say, to tell your dad that you're not giving him his allowance anymore. And also, so the reason it was Felipe's decision, I believe, is because the way it works in Spain is they get a set amount of money and the king decides how to spend that. But it was state money originally. And so, yeah, I think you can see already that like the UK and Spain are kind of separating themselves out into kind of bad abdications where the monarch was not well received after they abdicated because it wasn't a good abdication.
When I watched Napoleon, because obviously he was abdicating all the time, and they were like, we'll give you this much money. And then he didn't do what they said. And they're like, okay, we'll give you significantly less money now. And that's just like the vibe I get from Edward VIII all the time. And they're like, yeah, you can have this. But if you displease me, then you do nothing.
I mean, I would be quite happy if somebody told me, I will give you millions of pounds, but you have to stay in France. Like, that's not a punishment.
Well, I'll be going to Disneyland all the
Yeah,
time.
exactly. It's great. Have you been to France? It's lovely. So,
They have a lot of bread.
yeah.
I'll be happy.
I, yeah, exactly. Bread and croissants. Like, you're giving me millions of pounds and I get to eat croissants all the time. This is the dream life.
How do I abdicate and get
Yeah,
a
do I have to?
set salary?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll do it. Cool. So that's the category of those who kind of got their money taken away from them.
And the other category is the ones who didn't.
Yeah. Those are the only two options.
Yeah, they did or they didn't. So, you know, in the Netherlands, the Royal House Finances Act of 1972 exists, and essentially it's like, yep, once you abdicate, this is how much money you get, and that's how much money they get.
Yeah, so they have she gets a Beatrix gets a personal allowance of €465,000. Which is higher than Maxima gets as the queen, but lower, quite a lot lower than the king gets. She also gets €965,000 reimbursement for staff expenditure and like official duties and stuff like that. So it's €1.3 million in total, but it doesn't all go directly into her pocket.
Similarly, you know, like in Luxembourg, I think, because again, these are both countries where they're abdicating is becoming a tradition. So he abdicated and went to a little his little castle, and he lived there for like another 20 years, nearly, it must be like 15 years, and he was still getting his allowance.
Just about Luxembourg, they actually so they reformed their finances quite recently. You might remember because of like the Maria Theresa controversy. The state has been gradually trying to get more influence over the monarchy in Luxembourg. You can go and listen to our episode. I think "What If We're the Bad Guys?" I think it's called, where we talk about this. But basically, they reformed the finances, and so it says in the guidance that there's a fixed allowance depending on which position you have now. So rather than sort of changing it, there's a fixed allowance. So the former head of state. It gets an allowance of just over 215,000 euros, but they are allowed to see it to spend it as they see fit. That's their personal allowance because the official expenditure of the monarchy is paid directly by the state.
In Belgium, they did their rejigging of the finance system in 2014, and they were like, we can give money to the heir. So this is the money they give to, not the king. So like we can get all the not the king or queens, everyone else. So, like we can give emoluments to the heir, to any abdicated king or queen, surviving spouses of any of those categories, or the surviving spouse of the king or queen. On the 1st of January 2014, King Albert II was receiving 923,000 euros.
About $1 million.
So that's, I assume he's getting about the same amount now. I assume they're not taking money away from him, it being Belgium. But he's a fair chunk of money, okay? He's getting.
They have kind of two parts to the payment, similar to the Netherlands. So they have one part which is for their job. No, sorry, for their time, like for their labor, and that's taxed. And then the other part is for like their staffing and like cars and stuff like that that they need to get to work. Interesting thing about Belgium is that they only get the emolument allowance on condition that they don't have any other taxable income.
I like that. That's a good rule. We should all put that one in place.
I really think that we should do that for our politicians anyway. So it means that like they can't go off and start consulting for a random firm and get loads of money and kind of do dodgy things to sort of supplement their income because they don't get their main allowance if they do that, which I thought was very smart.
Japan, next on the list. So they have the all property of the imperial household and belongs to the state, because they're kind of back in our episode about power, cones of power. We spoke about how they are an incredibly unusual royal family because they are very much ruled by the household rather than ruled by the monarch. But the budget for the imperial household consists of personal expenses, palace expenses, allowance, and palace-related expenses. So the I don't know which year this is from, 23rd, 2023, so last year, the palace-related expenses obviously just goes to all the palaces. The allowance, which goes for everyone apart from the king and the inner court members, because they're slightly different, they get a total of 260 million yen, which is then distributed out to all of them, including the Emperor Emeritus. And then the personal expenses as well, which was 324 million yen. So it's kind of the same way, almost like the same way Spain works, or worked before Juan Carlos got cut off, in the fact that it all went to the goes to kind of the person in charge, which in this case is not the monarch, and then they distribute it evenly amongst everyone else.
Yeah, sorry, I was just trying to convert yen. I think 324 million yen is $2.2 million. It's like when I was watching Squid Game, and I was like, wow, that's a huge amount of money they win. And then when you convert it from Korean money into dollars or pounds, you're like, okay, well, it's still a lot of money, but it's not quite as much because sorry, this is a real tangent, but I used to love going to Europe before the euro. Because we went to Portugal a lot and they had escudos. And so you'd be like, I have 100 escudos. And I never had 100 pounds as a child, but you don't understand conversion. So you're like, I feel rich.
So, wow, I've made so much money.
Yes. Sorry. Yeah. I think in Japan, they have a real thing. I think it's similar to like the taxable income thing in Belgium of like, They really want to protect the dignity of the monarchy in Japan, of like, you know, they're behind closed doors. They're what they wear is controlled heavily, so they all sort of look in a uniform. There's a lot of control around that. And so, like, if a in Japan, when a princess marries somebody who's outside of the family, they lose their title and are no longer officially part of the royal house. And they get given a lump sum to sort of tide them over. And so the idea of that is, like, we'll give you money. A generous amount of money in order to, you know, you don't have to go on a Japanese reality TV show and degrade the image of the monarchy. So it's unsurprising that they would do that for the emperor, you know, if they do that for a random princess.
Yes, just imagining Emperor Akihito on like Japanese MasterChef.
Japanese MasterChef must be amazing.
I know, so I've said that, I just thought that would be a great show. Does that exist? I would watch that. So the only other country left is Denmark, where we don't really know what exactly what they're doing. I assume it will be following the same method as the last gaggle, especially considering, you know, she's very popular in Denmark. It seems unlikely they would cut her off. But then she does also have extracurricular
Yeah, that's true.
jobs. So we don't know for sure where we're going with this one.
I would be absolutely shocked if she doesn't get an allowance, even if it's not necessarily like part of what the monarchy currently gets, if she gets like a separate allowance, because they gave one to Joachim's ex-wife. So Joachim was married before. He was married to Marie. We call him Mr. Marie, but he was married to a woman called Alexandra before that. So he was used to be Mr. Alexandra. She was immensely popular. She was often compared to like the Danish Diana. And she came in before Mary as well. So she was like immensely popular. And when they divorced, everyone was devastated. And because of her popularity and also the fact, I suppose, that she had two princes, or they were princes at the time, she was given a government allowance for the rest of her life. And she gave that up. When her children turned 18, but she could have kept that for the rest of her life. So I would be shocked if they don't give one to Margrethe.
You're like, yeah, you don't get one. You quit on us. So.
Exactly. That would be shocking. So I think, you know, other than the examples of the UK and Spain, which are particular, because the monarch kind of, it was like a punishment, essentially. It's a privilege to get a money from the state is essentially the attitude, but everyone else has kept some level of money as a sort of guarantee from the state. And there's different ways how that works, so it might be split up based on what they do as work and personal allowances, or you know, the taxable income thing in Belgium. So there are differences, but broadly speaking, everybody gets some sort of money, and I do think that that is fair. And one of the reasons, we'll talk about that in a second. So they still often will be doing work. They have a staff to maintain, and they probably can't afford to suddenly do that all themselves. But also, it kind of reminds me of like a state pension. Royals have a very different lifestyle to the average pensioner. But I think a lot of it is about kind of, if we agree to keep giving you money, then that means that you're not going to be going on Big Brother at 68 as the former monarch, and kind of, you know, because you've got no money left over. There is usually some sort of downgrade in the amount of money. So, like in the Netherlands, we know that Beatrix would have got like double the amount when she was queen as what she gets now. But, and that kind of reflects the fact that they don't have as much of a role anymore. They aren't doing as much necessarily. But they are generally well taken care of unless they do something really bad. It would be much worse if the monarch didn't have any money whatsoever and still had to maintain a certain lifestyle and staff and all those sorts of things, and ended up doing something that monumentally embarrassed the country by, like, maybe, I don't know, taking money from a from an enemy state to spy on the government. You know, like that would be much worse.
Yeah, that wouldn't really go down well, I don't think.
No. So it's probably best for the best.
So, for the kind of next final section, we were thinking about what do they actually do after they've abdicated? What do these abdicated people do with their lives? And the first group of people are the ones who do nothing. And they are normally the ones who end up in some kind of exile or get cut off from the government.
No one will be surprised who they are.
No one likes them anymore. So, one of those examples is King Edward VIII, who, the then Duke of Windsor, because they were like, you can't be in the UK. We don't want you to be here in Parliament. So, unsurprisingly, he couldn't really do any work for the British government at that point, or, you know, on the British taxpayer. So it's not really a surprise that he couldn't do anything and spent his entire time hosting lavish parties in France.
What a shame. He was like, he was briefly like governor of the Bahamas or something, but I think that was a job that was mostly given to him to keep him busy.
Yeah, so he stopped trying to come back to England. Stopped trying to find loopholes in his plans.
Exactly. They didn't do anything in the UK anyway.
And the other one is Spain. So King Juan Carlos did do some work after he immediately abdicated. You know, we'd see him at like sort of Easter Sunday services, or he'd occasionally be with Felipe for military things. And then when he ended up in self-imposed exile, he was not going back to Spain in case he got arrested, so very much stopped doing things. And now when he goes back to Spain, he kind of sneaks in under the cover of darkness.
Yes.
And then you see like, a photo of him in a car, like, Juan Carlos is backing Spain.
Yeah.
So he doesn't do work anymore either. He's also stopped doing work.
Yeah. He comes back for things like for Leonor's 18th birthday. He didn't come back for the big ceremony, but he went to the party in the evening. So it's like he doesn't have any official role, but he does still come back for some things here and there. And it's increasingly happening that he's coming back to Spain. His wife, Sophia, does do engagements, which is interesting. It makes sense if you think about it. We've just talked about the finance part of it. And so if those are the two people who didn't get any state money, so they don't do any state work. But just like you don't, you know, they're not going to volunteer. So makes sense. It costs a lot of money to run a monarchy. So
don't get paid if you don't do the job.
Exactly. And yes, obviously volunteers do exist, but generally volunteering expenses are like traveling to the volunteering place and back again. Whereas their voluntary expenses would be like 7 members of staff
and a new hat.
Yeah, they can't afford all that. So we've got those who kind of don't have any official role. All of the rest of them do kind of maintain some level of official duties or some responsibility, but there are different levels of activeness depending on kind of circumstance. So some examples of monarchs who are still quite active after abdication. So in Belgium, Albert II was the last monarch to abdicate, and he does do less now, because his health is not fantastic. But initially, he did a lot of work. And the only reason that he's not doing as much work is because of his health. But he's still going to big things. So he was at an event in November with his wife, Queen Paola, who still has a number of sort of official patronages and still has, because she's very healthy, she still has quite a lot of responsibilities and still goes to a lot of engagements. So they were at something in November, which wasn't that long ago. He also went to the big sort of National Day Te Deum celebration last summer. So like he still does make the effort to go to, you know, not just the big national events, but also sometimes the smaller ones where his health allows. Another example is the Netherlands. Beatrix is very active. You see her quite a lot. She still definitely has patronages. Because she was abdicating as a matter of tradition and not because everyone hated her, she is able to still keep up the role. She still gets a lot of money to be able to carry out her work. So there is sort of an anticipation that she would be, or an expectation, sorry, that she would be carrying out work because she gets paid for it. One thing to say about the Netherlands is that, and I think it's actually the same in Belgium and Luxembourg, is that by law, only the monarch can sign the laws. So in the UK, as I mentioned, the Council of State thing earlier, if Charles is away, somebody else can kind of deputize for him and sign the laws in the Commonwealth countries. We have the Governor Generals who sign the laws as in place of the monarch, because Charles can't be going to every single country and signing all the things. Whereas in countries like the Netherlands, in the law, it is only the monarch. Nobody else can deputize. So, you know, I guess theoretically, if Charles abdicated in a nice, happy way, he could maybe step in and be a councillor of state when William's overseas. But in the Netherlands, even though Beatrix is very popular and still very active, that is something that she can't do. Whereas in other countries, the monarch can do that.
Isn't Margrethe also a councillor?
Yes.
They don't even call them councillor of state now, but she can be regent.
They're like Regenverstander or something. I don't know, in Danish. Yeah. She can do that. Yes. So yeah, that's one example of like a country where anybody can sign a law who's allowed, essentially. And so Margrethe has the ability to step in for Frederick when he's overseas and sign the laws for him. But in the Netherlands, that is not possible. So that, but that's not just for an abdicated monarch. That's for everybody. But it, I think, just shows that once you're no longer the monarch, even though you used to do it, that doesn't mean you have any like vestigial power. Or, you know, they let you sign the laws as well. You know, nothing like that. And then, yeah, I guess there's the other ones who are active but slightly less active, perhaps, are Luxembourg. So Grand Duke Jean was the last person to abdicate. He did continue to take part in some events, but they tended to be mostly like the major national events, like National Day, and the same in Japan. So we still see the emperor pop up every now and then, but he is quite unwell, and so there will be times where his health means that he can't participate in things.
And then they're not really an outlier, but we don't really know what they're doing. So they are an outlier is Denmark, because we know, we spoke about last time how we know that they have taken away all the patronages from Margrethe, Frederick, and Mary. And they've stayed very quiet on what Margrethe will be doing next. So we don't know if she's going to be popping up in a Beatrix style manner, just doing what she used to do all the time. Or if she's going to turn up, at like New Year's or Frederick's birthday, or if we're never going to see her again, apart from when she, is on the red carpet for a Netflix show. We don't know where they're going with this one.
And it's quite difficult for us to predict because we don't know the finances either. I bet by the time this episode comes out, they'll have clarified it because they always do this.
Yeah, it's the day where it's released. Like earlier today, it was
Yeah.
announced.
All the flurry of activity happens between Monday and Wednesday. Oh, so annoying. And as I mentioned a few times, I think it makes sense that like if it was a traditional thing or if you abdicated and you were in a relatively positive position, people would want to still see you. Not everyone's exiled.
Some people get to do a bit more jobs.
Yeah.
Other people have to live in France and eat bread and suffer, honestly.
Eat bread and suffer is the episode title, I think.
Plot of Les Mis, I think.
Yes, I think that is exactly the plot of Les Mis. Eat bread and suffer. They should change the name. So our final topic that we're going to be discussing is essentially, you know, we've spent two episodes now covering abdications from, you know, the history of who has abdicated to the legal side of things to what happens in the practical day-to-day stuff after they abdicate. Now we're going to be looking into the future and thinking about whether or not we will see more abdications. That seems to be the question everyone is talking about, and you know, every single monarch is being asked, are you planning to abdicate now that Margaret has abdicated? And everyone's saying, this is the beginning of the era of abdications. Everyone's gonna, you know, and people are making a big deal about it. And we've already had some explicit denial. So King Harold was asked, are you going to abdicate? And basically said, no, I made an oath and it's for life, so I'm not abdicating. And the Swedish court was asked about whether Carl Gustaf was going to abdicate. And they said, we refer you to our previous statement that basically says no. So, you know, I also think like Charles probably won't abdicate. I think the era of abdication, like as if we're moving into a new era, is perhaps overstated slightly. I think like we've had the era of abdication now.
Yes, it's been and gone.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's caught on to this really late. Like there was loads of abdications, and then Margrethe does it, and everyone's like, wow, this is the era of abdication. It's like, okay, but it's done now. So I think, yeah. So I think my thought is abdication doesn't become a tradition because one person abdicated. So I don't think that even, you know, Margrethe's decision means that Frederick will necessarily automatically abdicate. I also don't think that I buy the argument that people are making that like Margrethe abdicated because it is the era of abdications, because we've had lots of abdications in the last 25 years. I think it's relatively insulting to be like, oh, well, the monarchs are all just following each other and copying each other. And the people of Denmark are interchangeable with the people of Belgium. Margrethe abdicated for her own reasons as the Queen of Denmark. Albert II abdicated for his reasons as the King of the Belgians. Beatrix abdicated because it's traditional in the Netherlands. So I don't think that Margrethe's decision to abdicate is necessarily going to mean that we see a flurry of abdications in the future, or that it even becomes the norm in Denmark. If Frederick decides not to abdicate, I wouldn't be surprised.
There, like, I would be surprised if William Alexander doesn't abdicate when it comes to his time, I would be less surprised if Grand Duke Henri doesn't abdicate, because he's like abdication age and just seems to still be going. Knowing my luck, he's going to announce his abdication tomorrow. But I could see him going either way. But I don't, yeah, I think there's a real tendency, and I'm not blaming Americans, but I think it is what I'm going to call the American view of Europe as like a homogenous beast of countries, and everyone does the same thing, and they kind of do what Britain does, and if they don't, they're doing it for Britain. So, like Margrethe took
Oh, yeah.
Shoah Kim's children's titles away for Charles, and she's abdicated to show Charles it's okay. Like, guarantee she didn't think about Charles from one part in this
No, it's so
situation.
patronizing to Danish people.
I know. But I think I mean, there is such a fundamental difference between England and Wales and Scotland, and they are quite literally one country ruled by one government and one man. So to assume that Luxembourg and Denmark are in any way similar is bizarre. And I think you've also got to look at things you can't predict, like financial crashes and wars, and because if there is, the Netherlands end up in a war, possibly King William Alexander's not going to decide that's the best time to abdicate. So it's not impossible that there's going to be a dramatic political change that could render everything to do with tradition sort of obsolete. But sort of as things are going, I think abdication will remain the norm in some countries like Luxembourg and the Netherlands, and I highly doubt it will happen in other countries like the UK or even places like Japan. I can't see them abdicating often, and then I just think it's sort of on a case-by-case basis. Like if you're ill and you can't do your job, you probably are going to have to either abdicate or install a regent. So
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think I don't really like predicting the future, obviously, because historically we've been quite wrong about that. So I don't really like predicting the future. I don't like when people ask me like hypothetical questions that there's nothing that I can really use as evidence. Like I can if somebody asked me if the next monarch in the if Willem Alexander in the Netherlands will abdicate, I would have some evidence to go, okay, yeah, I think it because it's happened for several generations, it will probably happen with him. But that's not a definite. It's just a probably. And there are other countries where, as I mentioned, just because Margrethe did it's not enough. On it's 900 years between her and the last one, so we can't necessarily predict what's going to happen. And yeah, any circumstance could happen. Like, what if the monarch's younger brother is the heir to the throne? He doesn't have any children of his own, and his brother's 5 years younger. If you're not going to abdicate to bring in the new generation of young people, and then to just give it to somebody who's 5 years younger than you, I just there are all sorts of things that could influence the circumstances, and we don't know what those things are yet, so we can't really say. But I don't think that there's going to be loads of abdications now because the only real options have ruled out. So if there are abdications, these are things that we're going to be looking at in a few decades' time, and it's just we just don't have enough information to be able to know that. The only thing that I think could happen is I don't think that the monarch looks to another country and goes, oh, that person abdicated, so I should. But I think that the public could, like the public in the UK might look at what's happening in Denmark and might go, oh, well, their abdication went really well and it seems to be really popular in Denmark. Maybe we should have that over here in the UK. And then there'll be like little whispers, people going, oh, I wonder if we should abdicate. And maybe those whispers will get louder and louder. And then the monarch will feel like, well, I have to abdicate because everybody wants me to.
Yeah, like the only country Margrethe made it easier to abdicate in was
Was
Denmark,
Denmark,
because
yeah.
now if Frederick does it, they'll be like, oh yeah, his mum did that, so fair enough. It's like it doesn't really affect anyone else.
Exactly. That's an excellent summary. So, thank you for joining us for this episode this week. Apologies again for stepping on my headphones. I've got new microphone and everything, so if the audio quality is excellent in this episode, that was as a result of me standing on my headphones. If it's terrible, that was also a result of me standing on my headphones. So we'll see how it turns out. Yeah, but other than that, it is a goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.